Omaha Public Radio presents another program from Creighton University on Noon Forum. We'll hear a talk given by J. Wells Dixon, an attorney with the Center for Constitutional Rights in New York City, and an expert on Guantanamo Bay prisoners. Mr. Dixon's appearance was co-sponsored by the Creighton University School of Law and the Creighton Department of History. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday afternoon, September 25th, 2008, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of Creighton University, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Sean Watts, a professor in the Creighton School of Law.
Before I introduce the speaker, I'd like to take just a few moments to acknowledge the efforts of some of the people that made this event possible. First, I'd like to thank the law school staff and faculty, but especially Professor Mike Kelly for his support for this event. I'd also like to acknowledge the critical support of the Henry Casper Professorship in History out of the College of Arts and Sciences. Dr. John Calvert holds this position currently, and his support was critical to this opportunity. Finally, and most importantly, I'd like to thank my colleague, Scott Eastman, for his dedication and hard work. This would not have been possible without his work, and we owe him a great debt of gratitude. Well, since its very beginning, the United States Global War on Terrorism, or as we've taken to calling it in some governmental entities, the Long War, has been characterized as a new paradigm of armed conflict. The conclusion that the attacks of September 11 represented something new for us was originally derived from an analysis of the source of these attacks. Rather than coming from the conventional source of state actors, they represent the acts of a network of loosely affiliated non-state actors, not motivated by national or ethnic allegiance, but by extreme conceptions of cultural and religious ideology. Despite its purportedly novel character, the United States' early responses to this conflict focused on very conventional means of warfare, large-scale military operations intended to destroy and to detain as many enemy as possible. Central to this war-focused effort was the establishment of a long-term detention facility at the United States Naval Base at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, where the United States holds a perpetual lease. Almost from its inception, the facility at Guantanamo Bay sparked extreme controversy. Focused initially on alleged violations of previously obscure and insular international documents like the law of war and international human rights treaties, legal and policy debate concerning Guantanamo matured quickly into broader questions about our own domestic law and even the nature of power in our domestic governmental structures. As a byproduct of these debates, yet perhaps too late by many accounts, the United States has begun to perceive this struggle not as a conventional war of attrition or a contest of will, but rather as a conflict of ideas. Thus, recent efforts in the war have included campaigns focused on preventive measures, including nation-building and so-called rule-of-law operations. While this conception may hold the key to a successful strategy, it's also presented us with some of the most intractable and perhaps fundamental legal policy questions that we've yet faced, namely, the task of defining the nature of this war and our own relationship to the rule of law. That is, to what extent are we willing to be held to our own rhetoric as regards the rule of law? Well, to answer and to address some of these very important issues, we're indeed fortunate to have our guest speaker, Mr. J. Wells Dixon. Mr. Dixon is currently an attorney with the Center for Constitutional Rights, where he's involved in the center's Guantanamo Global Justice Initiative. In this capacity, he represents a number of persons detained at Guantanamo Bay, including some that are subject to trial by military commission. He recently was part of the legal team that argued and won the very important Boumediene case before the United States Supreme Court. Mr. Dixon has published widely on national security issues in publications including the Washington Post and the New York Times, and he's appeared on numerous programs including All Things Considered on National Public Radio. He's a graduate of Johns Hopkins University and the University of Colorado School of Law, where he was an editor of the Law Review. Please join me in a warm welcome for our guest speaker, Mr. J. Wells Dixon.
I suspect for many of you, Guantanamo Bay elicits a variety of different images. It elicits memories of the World Trade Center. It elicits memories or images of men with black hoods and orange jumpsuits, of wire cages and open-air prisons at Guantanamo. And I'm sure for many of you, as for me, it raises a lot of questions, questions that we grapple with every day, questions that we grapple with individually and also as a country, questions like, what do we do about terrorism? What is the role of Islam? What about torture? What about separation of powers? What is the appropriate relationship between the executive branch of government and the judiciary in a time of war? And at what point do we depart from the rule of law, if ever? I think to address these questions in context of Guantanamo, you really have to go back to the immediate aftermath of September 11th. And 7 days after the attacks in New York City and Washington, the Congress passed a resolution called the Authorization for Use of Military Force. And what that authorization did was it provided the President of the United States with a green light to use force, to use all necessary and appropriate force to go after the people that were responsible for 9/11. It was that resolution that paved the way for the United States to take military action in Afghanistan in October of 2001. So the United States invaded in early October with the intent of capturing or killing Osama bin Laden, of dismantling al-Qaeda, and of ultimately toppling the Taliban government that was shielding al-Qaeda for so many years. It was shortly after that incursion into Afghanistan that the United States began to capture or detain large numbers of suspected fighters, people from all over Afghanistan, Pakistan, a number of different places. And the question arose about what to do with these people. You know, we're bringing in all of these suspected fighters, these suspected terrorists. What do we do with these people? Well, a decision was made in December of 2001 to transport the men to Guantanamo Bay. Now, Guantanamo Bay, at the time of 9/11, was an aging relic of the Cold War. It was a Navy base that had been scheduled to be closed. It was a Navy base that we had occupied really since the Spanish-American War. We had occupied pursuant to a treaty and ultimately pursuant to a lease. And as I said, it was scheduled to be closed. It wasn't being used for anything other than as a landing strip for the Coast Guard when they would go out to do drug interdiction in the Caribbean. Occasionally, it was used for refugee operations in Haiti, places like that. So it begged the question, well, why Guantanamo? Why would the United States choose to transport suspected fighters thousands of miles from the battlefield to Guantanamo? It was chosen for a very particular reason. It was chosen because it was thought to be a legal black hole. We were told by the administration that it was the legal equivalent of outer space. That is a place where no law applied. And the reason that the United States chose a place where no law was supposed to apply was because the military and the administration wanted to find a place where they could detain and interrogate suspected fighters without interference from Congress, and without interference in particular from the judicial branch of government. And Guantanamo, in that sense, really rested on three principles. The first principle was isolation. We'll take these prisoners and we'll transport them thousands of miles from home, and we'll isolate them from the rest of the world. We'll isolate them on the southeast tip of Cuba from the public, from the press, from everybody. And the second principle was secrecy. We'll hold them in secret. We won't disclose what's happening to these people. There'll be no outside observers. Ultimately, the Red Cross did come in, but initially there was nobody. And then the third principle was dependency. Using isolation and secrecy, the idea was that we would make the prisoners entirely dependent on their interrogators. If you wanted to get out of Guantanamo Bay, the way you would do it was through your interrogator. If you cooperated with your interrogator, you would get soap and you'd get a towel, comfort items. If you cooperated with your interrogator, they would provide the only hope of getting out of Guantanamo and getting back to your home country. But this notion of a legal outer space or a place where no laws apply was really unprecedented. As far as I know, it had never existed. That concept had never existed in the United States before, or as a matter of United States policy before. And I think it reflected really a cynical view, certainly of the judiciary, the role of the judiciary in a time of war. The thought was that we have to keep people outside the reach of the federal courts, because a federal court might take a look at the basis for someone's detention and decide that there is no basis, there is no legal basis, and they should be released. Or they might look at what happened to somebody and decide, well, you know what, that crossed the line, that was torture. And that was something that was not acceptable to the administration at the time. Also reflected in this choice to send people to Guantanamo was a breathtaking, I say a breathtaking view of executive power. The notion that the President of the United States, as Commander-in-Chief, could detain people and interrogate people and essentially do whatever he wanted to do with people outside the role of U.S., outside the restrictions and limitations of U.S. law was unprecedented. Never before, to my knowledge, had the President had the ability to operate freely in his own mind without the limitations of the Constitution from which he derived his power. So it was unprecedented. The other unprecedented aspect of Guantanamo was that it reflected really a seismic shift in the way we addressed terrorism. Traditionally, we'd approach terrorism as through what we refer to as a criminal law paradigm. There's a paradigm that views acts of terror as crimes. It views events like the September 11th attacks as acts of mass murder. We view Al-Qaeda as a criminal organization, spreading across a number of countries throughout the world. It's a paradigm that could be characterized as one of strict adherence to law, particularly due process. And finally, a paradigm that viewed the executive branch of government as a co-equal branch of government with Congress and with the courts, not as a dominant branch of government. And it's with that paradigm, in that context, that we typically had addressed prior acts of international terrorism. The first World Trade Center bombing, for example, was a case that was prosecuted in the Southern District of New York. The 1998 embassy bombings in Kenya and Tanzania, prosecuted in New York. The case of Ahmed Rassam, who's the Millennium Bomber who was captured coming from Canada into the United States with the intent of blowing up Los Angeles International Airport at the Millennium. He was prosecuted. So was Zacharias Moussaoui, alleged to be the 20th hijacker, Richard Reed, the shoe bomber. These men had been prosecuted, and without exception, are in jail for long, long periods of time. As Professor Watts noted, after September 11th, a decision was made to apply a new paradigm. And since September 11th, we've applied what we refer to as a war paradigm. We're fighting a global war on terror, which is as much a war against an ideology as it is against a terrorist organization. And it's a paradigm in which the executive is paramount. The President of the United States does what he feels in his sole discretion is necessary to combat terrorism. And this notion of applying a war paradigm instead of a criminal law paradigm was a policy decision. It was a decision that was founded on questionable notions about separation of powers, the relationship between the branches of government. It was one that ignored, or at a minimum, obfuscated traditional laws of war, in particular the Geneva Conventions. And it was one that ultimately was designed to pave the way for aggressive interrogations. Interrogations, in our opinion, that crossed the line fairly quickly into torture. Why was this necessary? Why did the President of the United States need free rein to do these things? Well, if you go back to September 11th and you look at some of the rhetoric around that time, we were told it was a new kind of war. The gloves were going to come off. We're told that the men in Guantanamo were the worst of the worst. Donald Rumsfeld said, 2002, these were the best trained, most vicious killers on the face of the earth. And again, the president said that he needed the power to do whatever was necessary to whomever he thought was necessary for as long as he thought was necessary in order to protect the country. It was in that context that the first plane load of prisoners arrived in Guantanamo in January of 2002. And it was this plane load of prisoners and subsequent plane loads of prisoners who were put into what it was known as Camp X-Ray. That was the temporary prison structure in Guantanamo Bay. It looked like dog kennels with chain-link fences. You may have seen photos. photographs, typically when photographs are shown of Guantanamo, it's these images. One of the men that was transferred to Guantanamo Bay very early on was a man named David Hicks. David Hicks had been a kangaroo skinner in Adelaide, Australia. And he was captured with the Taliban, and he was transported to Guantanamo Bay. And it was David Hicks whose father decided that he wanted to challenge his son's detention in Guantanamo Bay. And it was David Hicks' father who made his way to our organization, CCR, and asked us to bring a challenge to his detention. So in February of 2002, we filed a habeas petition in federal court in Washington. That habeas petition was brought on behalf of David Hicks, another Australian, and a number of British citizens who, at that time, were also in Guantanamo. The case became known as the Rasool case, named after Shafiq Rasool, who's one of the British citizens who was part of that case. What we asked for was very, very simple relief. We said, look, these men in Guantanamo deserve a very basic right, which is to go into court and to make a case for why they're innocent. It's a minimal right. I think it's important to distinguish. This is not habeas corpus that you might think of in the post-conviction context. This is not the same kind of habeas that you have where a criminal defendant has had a trial and been convicted and exhausted his appeals and is now trying to mount a collateral challenge to that criminal conviction. This was the legal equivalent of someone who'd been thrown in the Tower of London during the 17th century, who finds a scrap of paper and writes on the scrap of paper, "Help me, I'm being detained in the Tower of London." And that piece of paper would be taken to the courts, and the legality of that detention would be adjudicated. That's what we were talking about, that minimum common law right to habeas corpus, which had its origins in Magna Carta in 1215. And it's that basic common law due process right that's enshrined in the Constitution, in the suspension clause of the Constitution, which would become a central focal point of litigation in later years. The government's response to our habeas petition was to say, no, the men in Guantanamo, they don't have any right to habeas. They're not citizens of the United States, and they're held outside the United States. They're in this black hole. And you know, after I started to travel to Guantanamo, I would think about that. And it struck me because going to Guantanamo, it really looks nothing like Cuba. It looks like, in many ways, like a microcosm of America. It's all Americans who are there. There's McDonald's, there's Starbucks. You know, the only real remnants of Cuba that you see in Guantanamo are the guard towers off in the distance. And occasionally, Cuban refugees will wash up literally on the beach in Guantanamo seeking asylum and refugee protection in the United States. In any case, Rasool went to the Supreme Court, which decided in June of 2004 that the men in Guantanamo do have this basic common law right to go into court and to petition for habeas relief. And the same day, the court decided another case called Hamdi. Now, Yasser Hamdi was an American citizen who was captured fighting with the Taliban against the United States in Afghanistan. And he was brought to Guantanamo until they figured out that he was an American citizen. Then he was brought to a military brig in the United States. Well, he petitioned as well for habeas corpus. And the same day the court decided Rasool, they decided Hamdi. And what the court said was that the state of war is not a blank check for the President of the United States. The court said that the authorization for use of military force may have granted the president the authorization to use force, but it didn't explicitly grant the president the power to detain people in military custody indefinitely. The court did go on to say that in these limited circumstances where you have someone who is actually fighting the United States on a foreign battlefield, that the laws of war would allow the president to detain that person. It was an incident of war for the president to be able to hold that person until the end of hostilities. Nonetheless, the court said, like Rasool, Hamdi has the right to challenge his detention. He has a basic due process right to go into court and to make a case for why he should be released. So Rasool and Hamdi together were really stinging defeats to the administration, to their notion that Guantanamo Bay would be, or could be, a legal black hole. At the time, was by no means certain that the court was going to either hear the cases or ultimately decide them in our favor. But there are two things that happened that I think had some impact potentially on the Supreme Court. One was a few days after the argument before the Supreme Court in the Rasool case, when the court was arguing the Hamdi case, the justices of the Supreme Court said to Paul Clement, who eventually became the Solicitor General, they said, well, under your theory of limitless executive power, can the President of the United States order that a prisoner in Guantanamo Bay be tortured? And the Solicitor General said, no, we don't, talked around the issue. And Justice Ginsburg put him on the spot and said, well, what about mild torture? What if what the President of the United States is doing in Guantanamo Bay is torture? Paul Clement's response was, our executive doesn't torture people. Well, it was that very same day, after that very same colloquy, that the photographs at Abu Ghraib were published on 60 Minutes. Second thing that happened, which we think may have impacted the court, was we submitted as part of our briefing in the Rasool case an amicus brief from Fred Korematsu. Fred Korematsu is the individual who lent his name to Korematsu versus United States, which was the Japanese internment case that many of you probably studied in constitutional law. And he described in his brief what that experience was like to be held by the United States government during a time of war without relief. And so together, those two things, we think, had some bearing on the Supreme Court's decision in the Rasool and Hamdi cases. What happened after those two cases is that the military created what's known as the Combatant Status Review Tribunals, the CSRTs, which were designed in response to Hamdi in particular to sort out who was in Guantanamo, to give them the basic process that the Hamdi court said that they were due, to figure out whether the people who were being held were in fact enemy combatants. But unlike the Hamdi case, which had focused on an individual captured with a rifle on a battlefield fighting the United States, the CSRTs examined whether or not someone was an enemy combatant based on a different standard. The standard was, well, does the person have any association with the Taliban or Al-Qaeda? It was essentially a much broader definition of enemy combatant than what the Hamdi court had sanctioned. And it's since that time, since the prisoners went through the CSRT process, that we've been arguing with the United States in court about what it means to have the right to go to court. You know, Hamdi and Rasool gave us the right to get inside the courthouse door. Since then, we've been arguing about what rights they have to vindicate inside the courthouse in front of the district court judges. We've been litigating questions like, what is the power of the president to detain someone who has a mere passing association with the Taliban? If you live in a house temporarily that's owned by the Taliban, is that enough to hold you indefinitely in Guantanamo Bay? If you have the right to petition for habeas relief, what kind of process is due? Do you have the right to see the evidence against you? Do you have the right to counsel? Do you have the right to the protections of the Geneva Conventions? These are all questions that we've been litigating for several years. In the intervening time, Congress has stepped in twice. In December of 2005, Congress passed the Detainee Treatment Act, which attempted to undo the Rasool case, to take away the power of the federal courts to hear habeas cases brought by Guantanamo detainees. We went back to the Supreme Court in 2006, and they decided, in a case called Hamdan, that, in fact, the Detainee Treatment Act didn't strip jurisdiction for the courts to hear these petitions. The Hamdan case also decided that the Geneva Conventions were, at a minimum, common Article 3 of the Geneva Conventions, which provides a baseline standard for humanitarian protection of prisoners, that protection applied to all Guantanamo prisoners. In response to that case, Congress passed the Military Commissions Act in October of 2006. In that case, that statute fixed the problem with the Detainee Treatment Act. It stripped jurisdiction from the federal courts. They no longer had the power to hear habeas petitions. It was that statute that we challenged in the Boumediene case. Boumediene is a Bosnian Algerian in Guantanamo And we challenged that as a violation of the suspension clause in the Constitution. It was a direct challenge under the Constitution to an act of Congress during a time of war, which really was close to unprecedented. But in June of this year, the Supreme Court decided that, in fact, the Military Commissions Act did violate the suspension clause, that detainees do have the right to petition for habeas, and that that habeas hearing should be prompt. It should happen soon. Well, that was 3 months ago, almost 4 months ago, and to date, there hasn't been a single habeas hearing. We are back in front of the district court judges litigating some of the same issues we've been litigating for years and years. What is the power of the president to detain these men, and what process is due for these men? Now, the first habeas hearing is scheduled for October of this year. But in the meantime, we did win one very important victory in Rasul. As we won the right to go to Guantanamo Bay, starting in August of 2004, lawyers from CCR and from other organizations have started to travel to Guantanamo Bay. And in doing that, have been able to pierce the veil of secrecy that surrounded Guantanamo Bay until that point, and to really shed light on what was a very dark place until that point in time. And traveling to Guantanamo Bay, having been there several times myself, you know, it gave us the opportunity to see who was there. We've been told that these people were the worst of the worst. Well, we had the opportunity to go there and to hear their stories and to listen to them, to meet them, to look them in the eye, talk to them face to face. And what we found was that really most were not the worst of the worst. Are there some people there who are bad? Yes, absolutely. Are most of them that way? No, certainly not. To give you an idea of who's there, I'll give you some statistics. And these are statistics that come from government documents, government information that was analyzed by some professors at Seton Hall. What they found was that there have been just under 800 people detained in Guantanamo since it was opened. There are currently about 250 who are there, most of whom are from the country of Yemen. These are people who are captured all over the world. These are not people who are just captured in Afghanistan fighting the United States. People were captured in Africa, people captured in Europe, people captured in Central Asia, people captured in Southeast Asia. They're from all over the world. And the population is so diverse that there are approximately 15 different languages among the detainee population. And looking at the claims against the detainees, what was found was that 92% of the men who were there were not alleged by the government to be senior Taliban fighters or even Al-Qaeda. 55% of them were not alleged to have ever committed a hostile act against anybody. And only 5% were captured by the United States. The overwhelming majority of people in Guantanamo Bay have been turned in for bounties, ranging anywhere from $5,000 apiece to $1 million or more. And that's how most people end up in Guantanamo Bay. They get captured by a bounty hunter. The bounty hunter takes them to a U.S. military base and says, here is a terrorist. I want my $5,000. The United States takes them, and they end up in Guantanamo Bay. Now, after the United States started sending people to Guantanamo, started looking at who some of these people were, they figured out at about the end of 2002 that there were about two or three dozen people who had any kind of intelligence value at all to the United States. And throughout that population, you know, we have a broad spectrum of people. The oldest person in Guantanamo, for example, was close to 100 years old. He was held for 2 weeks before he was sent back to Afghanistan. The youngest person in Guantanamo that we've heard about was about 10 years old. So you have a broad spectrum of people. But again, only about two, maybe three dozen were alleged by the government to have any intelligence value as of 2002. It raises the question, well, how did this happen? Why did this happen? Why are a lot of these people still in Guantanamo? As the commander of Guantanamo said, former commander said in January of 2005, he said, look, you know, sometimes we didn't get the right people. Well, if you look at why some of the people were held, You can see that's true. I mean, it's the issue of the bounties. People turn in for bounties. Look at the allegations against some of them. I have an Algerian client who described for me in June how the interrogations work. He said, the interrogator comes in and they show you a picture or something and they say, did you know this suspected terrorist when you were at the Culloden training camp in Afghanistan? My client will look at him and say, well, I didn't go to that training camp. The interrogator will say, no, it's a yes or no answer. Did you know this suspected terrorist when you were at the Culloden training camp? And they'll say, well, no. The interrogator will say, okay. Detainee admits staying at the going to the Culloden training camp and is not credible because he denies association with or knowledge of this person. That's the way the interrogations are run. And so it's easy to see how people ended up in Guantanamo. It's easy to see how in the fog of war, people are turned over, they end up in Guantanamo Bay. What's remarkable is that not a lot has happened since then. There hasn't been a great effort to admit that mistakes were made and to rectify those mistakes. That's true in the case of some of my clients, some of my other clients. I represent four men who are Uyghurs. Uyghurs are a Turkic Muslim minority group from Western China. My clients were cleared for release from Guantanamo in 2002. They were told this by their interrogators. You're cleared. Interrogators are going home. We don't have any more interest in you. But they remain in Guantanamo Bay. To this day, they remain in Guantanamo Bay. The reason they remain there is because China wants them back. China says, we want them back. We consider them terrorists. And we will throw them in jail. The United States, to its credit, has said we will not send them back to China because these men will face persecution and torture in China. But yet the United States won't send them to Europe, won't bring them here to the United States, won't help to resettle them in a third country because they don't want to upset China. China is an important ally of the United States, economically certainly, but also in terms of support for the global war on terror. China is a member of the Security Council and abstained from the vote in the Security Council in the UN when the United States went to make its case for war in Iraq. And so the Uyghurs are really a bargaining chip, and they sit in limbo in Guantanamo. And unfortunately, despite their clearance for release, they may be the last ones released from Guantanamo. I mean, they may be there when the lights go out in the prison because they don't have anywhere else to go. Same is true with one of our clients from Somalia. Somalia has no government to speak of at this time. But our client is a UN mandate refugee. He was designated as a refugee by the United Nations before he ended up in Guantanamo. The UN is trying to get him out of Guantanamo with our assistance and with help from the U.S. government, but there is nowhere to send him. So he too remains there and will probably be there until the lights go out. On the other hand, there are other prisoners in Guantanamo who have very different problems and very different issues. In September of 2006, the United States transferred from secret CIA detention to Guantanamo 14 men who the government refers to as high-value detainees. One of those men is a client of mine, Majid Khan. Majid Khan grew up in Baltimore, went to high school in Baltimore, had asylum in Baltimore. He used to work for the state of Maryland. And just about everything about him and what's happened to him is classified. As the government says, everything is classified. What I can tell you is that he was captured at his brother's house in Pakistan in March of 2003, and he disappeared for 3.5 years. Nobody knew where he was. His family thought he was dead until he arrived in Guantanamo in September 2006. And he came to Guantanamo with the other 13 so-called high-value detainees, including Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who was the confessed mastermind of September 11th. People say to me, well, what about Khalid Sheikh Mohammed? Khalid Sheikh Mohammed is not like a Uyghur. He's not like your UN mandate refugee client from Somalia. Should Khalid Sheikh Mohammed have the right to go into a U.S. court and petition in the United States for habeas relief under our Constitution? Should he have that right to do it? My response is always that the right to habeas relief is not an issue that's about Khalid Sheikh Mohammed or what he may have done. It raises the question about how we as a country treat those men or women that we think have committed the most horrible crimes, crimes like the attacks on September 11th. How we treat those individuals defines and it reflects our character as a country. If you look back in history, we have always provided prisoners, whether they were Nazis or Japanese generals, we've always provided people the basic right to go into court and to make a case for why they should be released. And there's really ultimately nothing to fear from habeas relief. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed is reported to have confessed to 9/11 before he was captured. If that is so, he will not be released through habeas corpus. A court will not release him. On the other hand, Majid Khan, who shouldn't be in Guantanamo, may be released through habeas. And if that happens, well, that's the way the system was designed to work, to sort out who should be released and who shouldn't be released. That's the system that the Supreme Court sanctioned in the Hamdi case, in the Rasool case, in the Boumediene case. But secret detention, enhanced interrogation techniques are fraught with problems. In contrast to habeas, this regime of taking people, maybe not putting them in Guantanamo initially anymore, but holding them in secret overseas prisons, it raises issues not just about whether it's right to torture people, whether extraordinary rendition is appropriate, but it creates real practical problems for the United States. You know, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed is on trial now in a military commission in Guantanamo, and his trial is in jeopardy. The prosecution may not be able to introduce some of the evidence it wants because the CIA admits that they waterboarded him. If he'd been put on trial in a criminal court rather than put in secret detention, it's possible he may have agreed to cooperate with the United States. He might be on death row in a federal penitentiary in Colorado. We don't know. And there's also a danger. People say, well, what about, you know, the ticking time bomb scenario? What about the need to get intelligence value to prevent future attacks on the United States? Well, there's a real practical risk to that as well. There's a man named Sheikh al-Libi who was captured in 2001 in Afghanistan. It was reportedly taken to Egypt and tortured. And it was Sheikh al-Libi who reportedly provided information about the connection between Saddam Hussein and al-Qaeda and the desire of al-Qaeda to obtain nuclear technology from Saddam Hussein. It was information from al-Libi that he provided under torture that became part of the basis for the presentation that Colin Powell did to the United Nations when he made the case for the war in Iraq. We now know, in retrospect, that there wasn't a connection between Saddam Hussein and al-Qaeda, however bad either of them might have been. There was no connection, but yet he confessed to it, and that was part of the case that was made for war. And it also, you know, it creates a conundrum. It's really just a conundrum of our own making in the way that we've dealt with these men. On the one hand, we want to apply a war paradigm. We want to approach terrorism now as a war, but we don't want to recognize the people that we capture as prisoners of war. We don't want to treat them the way we treated the Nazis during World War II. We don't want to give them the protections of the Geneva Conventions. So we've obscured or obfuscated or ignored international law. And we've opened up the door for things like waterboarding and torture. And it's created a lot of problems. You know, there's nothing more in the world, I think, the Khalid Sheikh Mohammed might want and to be viewed as a warrior against the United States. Well, you know what? We've given him that opportunity. We've put him on trial in Guantanamo in a military commission, saying that he violated the laws of war. And he's now down in Guantanamo grandstanding and talking about how awful the United States is. And there's no end game. You know, for Majid Khan, you know, the details of his detention are classified. But I can tell you this, that the United States says that everything that happened to him is classified because there are intelligence sources, there are intelligence methods. Well, if you think about that, that is a startling proposition, because if Majid Khan is charged by a military commission or charged criminally in the United States or appears before a habeas court and he's acquitted or a judge orders him released, you know, the government's current thinking, they will not release him. They will continue to hold him, because the moment he gets out, he can go out and he can say to the outside world, this is what happened to me, this is where it happened, this is who's responsible. The government is not willing to let that happen under the current thinking. So there's no end game. You know, there's no end game for what they're going to do with Majid Khan if he's tried and acquitted, if he's convicted and serves his sentence. Under the government's theory, he will never be released. They don't know what to do with him. This is part of the problem that we have created by our use of secret prisons and legal black holes. In any case, it ultimately doesn't matter, really, for the men in Guantanamo, whether you're a Uyghur and you were cleared in 2002 or 2003, or whether you're Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. You're in Guantanamo, and you're there indefinitely. You know, and the fact that you're a Uyghur and you've been cleared doesn't mean anything. There's no material benefit to you in Guantanamo Bay being cleared for release. I had an interesting experience when I was down earlier in the year. And we took a break from a meeting with one of my Uyghur clients. And this guard that was minding us at the time while our client went to use the bathroom, I was talking about our Arab client. He's talking about your Arab client. And I finally looked at him and I said, so, you know, actually, the client is not Arab. He's Uyghur. And he said, what's Uyghur? And I said, he's from Western China. And he looked at me and he said, you mean to tell me that there are people here from China? I looked at him and I said, you mean to tell me you didn't know that? You know, you're a guard here. You've been a guard here for, I don't know, years. And you didn't know this. I mean, the military is trained not to inquire into who these people are. They must plan. As a matter of military necessity, they must plan for the worst-case scenario. What that means for our clients is that there's no benefit to being cleared for release. Guantanamo has certainly changed over time, though. You know, early on, we had Camp X-Ray. We had allegations of physical abuse, sleep deprivation, beatings, things like this. Desecration of the Quran. Now, these are things that we heard about when we started to go to Guantanamo. We heard these things from our clients, and we were sort of skeptical. And we said, well, you know, they really desecrate the Quran? I don't know. And then the FBI started to put out its reports about some of these things happening. Well, it's not like that as much anymore. Guantanamo is now more institutionalized. We have permanent prison facilities, supermax facilities there. There are two of them, Camps 5 and Camp 6. Now the men are held in isolation. They have very little interaction with one another, very little access to fresh air and sunlight. And in many ways, it's worse for them than it was earlier. You know, they're being warehoused at this point, many of them. And it's had a tremendous toll on them. I mean, the results are predictable. There have been 4 suicides in Guantanamo. There's a 5th detainee who died in captivity. There have been numerous suicide attempts. And a lot of the prisoners, quite honestly, have become very, very ill, very mentally ill. People hear voices. They have no sense of hope. And it's complicated our work as lawyers. You know, we go down to Guantanamo Bay because we need to make a case in a federal court for why these people should be released. Or if the military has the power to detain them, you know, to make arguments about what kind of process they should have. But we go down there and you go into a room and you meet with a client and, you know, they're disengaged. They're looking at the ceiling. They have no hope that a federal court's ever going to release them because to them, Guantanamo Bay still is a legal black hole. It still is the place where no laws apply. I mean, there hasn't been a single habeas hearing in 6 years. And they're hopeless. You know, clients have said to me in meetings, you know, after yelling at me for half an hour about not getting them out of Guantanamo, have said, you know, look, you've tried hard for me, and I appreciate that, and keep doing what you're doing, but I want you to do me a favor. I want you to go, and I want you to talk to my wife. And I want you to tell her to remarry because I'm dead and she should consider me dead. Just make sure that she sends our children to the right school. Make sure she takes care of them. And, you know, it's a very, very difficult situation to handle. I mean, I'm a lawyer. I'm not trained as a psychologist. I don't have experience with things like this before. And it makes our job very, very difficult. So when we go there, we spend as much time, I think, working on the legal cases as we do trying to make life a little bit better for the men that we represent. My Algerian client that I mentioned before had fled Algeria in the early 1990s to avoid the civil war there. And he had worked in Vienna, and then later he had lived in Canada. And he was a chef in Vienna at one point, and he was a very well-known chef for a famous restaurant in Vienna. So when I go to visit him, you know, we try to bring him food. We're allowed to bring in food. So we bring in food for him, Italian food, because that's what he loves. And occasionally, the military will let us bring in a photograph of one of his parents or his brother or something like this. And it gives us some opportunity to try to lift their spirits, which, you know, as a humanitarian matter, is necessary, but also is necessary in order for us to be able to work with them and to further their legal cases. But, you know, they can't hold out forever. And what's going to happen to a lot of these people is uncertain. It's not clear to me what's going to happen to the Uyghurs or to Majid Khan. What is clear is that there are really two ways to get out of Guantanamo. Two factors determine whether you get released. The first factor is what country you come from. You know, there is nobody from a European country in Guantanamo anymore. There's no one from a so-called Western country in Guantanamo anymore, with the exception of one person, Omar Khadr, from Canada. There are very few people from Saudi Arabia, because these are countries that have good diplomatic relationships with the United States. On the other hand, you have 95 people in Guantanamo from Yemen, because Yemen has a very complicated, very difficult relationship with the United States. And Yemen doesn't accept back its citizens, or the United States won't return them. So where country you come from really is the most significant factor, probably, in whether you get released. The second important factor in whether you get released is the threat of judicial review. You know, getting into court is probably not as effective as the threat of getting into court. Every time someone gets close to a hearing in federal court where a judge is going to look at the merits of their detention, decide what rights they have, that person gets released, without exception. That happened to Rasul, that happened to Hamdi, it's happened to a number of other prisoners. When a court gets close, that person gets released. So with the upcoming habeas hearings in the wake of the Boumediene case, we expect to see a greater number of people released from Guantanamo. It's certainly our hope. But we're nearing the end of the Bush administration. We're getting close to the elections. And our worry is that the Bush administration will just try to run out the clock and put the problem over to the next administration, whoever that might be. At this point, there's no dispute that these really are the dying days of Guantanamo Bay. You get the sense when you're down there, you get the sense from the prisoners, you get the sense from the military. We have that sense. Guantanamo Bay is closing. It's headed in that direction. Both of the presidential candidates have committed to closing it. And we think it's necessary. You know, Guantanamo Bay, it said, was founded on three principles. And it's failed of its essential purpose. You know, it is not a secret detention facility anymore. It's not so isolated from the world anymore. And the prisoners are no longer dependent only on their interrogators. But it's come at a great cost. In Guantanamo Bay, as we travel around the world to different countries to meet with prisoners' families and to work with government officials, we see that Guantanamo Bay is symbolic of the same things that Abu Ghraib. It's just it's viewed just the same way that Abu Ghraib is in most foreign countries. It's a symbol of lawlessness, torture. You know, for us here in the United States, it is a symbol of vast executive power. I think that those images and those perceptions of the United States and of Guantanamo Bay are dangerous. You know, they put U.S. soldiers to risk. You know, when the United States decided they weren't going to extend the protections of the Geneva Conventions to the Taliban, that put everyone who's fighting in Iraq at risk that the insurgency in Iraq would not afford those protections to the United States. And they would say, look, well, you know what? You've done that to the Iraqis who are in Guantanamo. We're going to do that to your soldiers in Iraq. It was very, very dangerous. And the irony is that it really wasn't necessary. It was, in fact, counterproductive. As I said before, you know, if we had applied a criminal law paradigm and had prosecuted Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, he would be in jail or on death row in the United States. And if we had freed the Uyghurs long ago by applying traditional military law of war procedures to sort out who is a combatant and who is a civilian, it would have lent greater credence or credibility to the notion that Guantanamo really is about fighting terrorism. It is not about the expansion of executive power at the expense of civil liberties and the rule of law. And it's ultimately regrettable. As the courts have said, at least since the Civil War, that our laws and our Constitution, they supply everything that's necessary to protect the country from threats and also to respect civil liberties and the rule of law. Thank you.
You've been listening to a program from the Creighton University Lecture Series. We've heard a talk by J. Wells Dixon, an attorney with the Center for Constitutional Rights in New York City, and an expert on Guantanamo Bay prisoners. His appearance was co-sponsored by the Creighton University School of Law and the Creighton Department of History. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday afternoon, September 25th, 2008, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Cindy Workman, Associate Director of Public Relations at Creighton University, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings are available on the Internet. Visit our website at kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.